Year of the Peer Podcast with Leo Battari, Season 1, Episode 2. Hi, I'm Randy Cantrell. Welcome to the Year of the Peer Podcast with Leo Battari. This podcast is based on a simple truth. Who you surround yourself with matters. Author and keynote speaker Leo Battari will interview thought leaders from all walks of life who will share how they leverage peer advantage and show you how engaging your peers more purposefully can hold the key to greater success in business and in life. Today's guest is Rich Carlgaard. Rich Carlgaard is the publisher and global futurist for Forbes magazine. He writes the biweekly column, Innovation Rules, and serves as a regular panelist on cable news' most popular business show, Forbes on Fox. He's an award-winning entrepreneur turned publisher, popular keynote speaker, and author of two best-selling books, The Soft Edge and Team Genius. Rich has a unique vantage point on the trends driving business and the economy, and he's here with us today to share his views. Let's get started, Leo.
Well, Rich, welcome to the show. So happy to have you here today.
Yeah, thanks, Leo. Great to talk to you as always.
You know, I love the work that you're doing right now in terms of kind of what's next. I know you're spending a lot of time on that. And I'm no futurist by any stretch of the imagination, but one of the reasons that we've kind of declared this year the year of the peer is, you know, we're coming off of a tough presidential election. Obviously, we tend to be probably in debate more than we are dialogue a lot of times. We've got a world that's fast changing. It's complex. And there's just, you know, so much going on out there that is not something we want to try to go along. You know, trust in institutions is down, whether it's media, business, government. And with that, I think we're going to have to rely on one another more than ever before, you know, to achieve what adaptability, which is, I know, a real theme of what you're talking about lately. But I'd love it if you could kind of share with us some of these mega trends that you've been talking about. And then let's get into a little bit about how we may be able to work together in order to be successful.
Yeah, first of all, I want to say that your work on peers and the effectiveness of peer group and peer coaching and peer counseling is really doing the Lord's work, because the world is getting more complex, business evolution is accelerating, and people are desperate for this kind of counseling and friendship, and they benefit greatly from it, as I've seen from the work you've done in the past. I think there are four big megatrends that you have to keep an eye on. Number one is global population. It's getting bigger, richer, older, and more urban. Now, everybody knows the bigger part. All you have to do is look at UN forecasts to see that we're going to go from 7.2 to somewhere between 9 and 9.5 billion by 2050. Right. But it's the richer, older, and more urban, I think, that is a more sophisticated analysis here. You take the richer. We've moved. There are now about between 1.5 billion and 2 billion people who are in the global middle class. That is to say, they have enough income where they have they can provide for their nutritional needs. They have a roof over their head, and they have some discretionary income. Number two, that's going to 4 billion between now and 2050. So it's doubling. The second thing is that we're becoming an older society. We have 600 million people who are over the age of 65 today on the planet. That's going to 1.5 by 2050. So we're adding incrementally almost 1 billion people over 65. You think about the business opportunities around people getting moving into the middle class and people getting older. They would be nutritional needs, healthcare needs, entertainment needs, housing needs, and then more urban. This is the real whopper. Is that we're going to, if you consider an urban area of 500,000 or greater, 2.5 billion people are going to go from rural areas to urban areas over between now and 2050. So that's greater than the overall population increase. You step back and you look at the opportunities presented by these demographic changes. And granted, these aren't over the next 5 to 10 years, but they will happen. And there are going to be trillion-dollar industries that are created about serving a larger middle class, an older middle class, a richer middle class, and a more urban middle class.
You know, when I first discovered that between 1950 and 2020, our world population will have tripled. And if you think about that, it's really unbelievable. And we know that that's just going to accelerate, right? I mean, that acceleration of the growth of world population is just really, really staggering to think about. So, you know, to your point, in terms of, you know, some of the opportunities and some of the challenges that we have here, I think are really extraordinary.
Yeah, and I think you have to think about the opportunities and think about the challenges in an optimistic way.
Sure.
Because if you go back to the 1970s when the planet maybe had 3 or 4 billion people, there were a lot of forecasts that we were going to run out of food, there would be mass starvation and so on. And human ingenuity came up with hybrid crops and all kinds of innovation that allowed us to feed more people and feed them better. So that isn't to say that all 9 billion people by 2050 are going to have comfortable middle class lives, but there is an opportunity to elevate humanity along the way and do well by doing good. The second thing goes to these good old, you know, technology rules that we face every day. Some of them are familiar, some of them not so much, but you know, Moore's law continues to chug along, this idea that everything in the digital realm gets twice as good at the same price point every 2 years. The flip side of that is that at the same performance point, price has dropped 30% a year, which is why we have cell phones as powerful as our laptops 10 years ago. But what's really cool on the world scale, and you don't see it so much in America, is the rise of the sub-$100 smartphone going to sub-$50 smartphone. And that catalyzes vast new markets in rural China, the poorer parts of Southeast Asia, India, Africa. And the forecast, Mary Meeker of Kleiner Perkins believes that we'll be going from 2 billion smartphone users in the world today to about 3.6 billion in just 4 years. Second technology law, the power of networks, Bob Metcalfe's tried and true, n times n minus 1 squared. That simply means that every time you add a node on the network, the number of connections among human beings grows almost exponentially. 3.6 billion smartphone users means 648 followed by 18 zeros of human connections. And I think, you know, one of the things that's interesting about living today is that ideas can come out of nowhere and go viral, and you wonder how that ever occurred. And I'm talking about ideas good and bad. I mean, good ideas, startups, social movements, bad ideas, you know, ISIS, terrorism. And that's because humans can find each other, can find other human beings of common interest without many human connections. Law number three, this one's underappreciated. Bill Joy was a co-founder of Sun Microsystems in the 80s. He was the software guru. If you read the book Outliers, Malcolm Gladwell had a chapter on how Bill Joy accumulated his 10,000 hours in computing at the University of Michigan Computer Center. Got his PhD at Berkeley. He was the software guru at Sun. And in the early 90s, before the web, it was obvious as it is today, made possible by the web browser and high band communications. When it was still pre-browser and narrow band, Bill Joy imagined that there would be a world where there would be all these smart devices, broadband communications, people communicating with each other. And he said the result of that is that we had to stop thinking of our companies as the sum of all the people on our payroll, and had to start thinking about our companies as part of the ecology of our industry. Mm-hmm. With all the talented people and all the friends and all the critics out there, you know, that could be part of our ecology. And this is true even small and medium-sized businesses, Leo. You know, this isn't just true for Apple or Microsoft or Google. It's true of, you know, 100-person, 200-person companies that they now have access. They have fans and they have critics all around the world. And so how do you create a company of 100 or 200 people that really takes advantage of all these voices and all these cool ideas out there? Sure. Law number four, Marc Andreessen, who did give us the web browser in the form of Netscape in 1995, now very successful venture capitalist with Andreessen Horowitz, said a couple of years ago a very provocative statement that software eats everything. Scared people, Certainly, if you're a taxi cab driver, you know what it means. Uber, you know, Uber's eaten you. What will AI and machine learning do? But we have to reconcile ourselves with that. And what he really said when he teased out the statement is more and more industries, even traditional industries, even heavy industries, even the U.S. military, for crying out loud, would be delivered as software platforms. An idea that retired four-star General Stanley McChrystal confirmed to me when I interviewed him about 9 months ago, and he was talking about JSOC, the Joint Strategic Operations Command, which is his last post before he retired, and how you manage, you know, the collection of the Navy SEALs and the Army Rangers and the Delta Force and all the coolest of the cool, the drones providing video with analytics providing information, predictive information, and it's the military as a software platform. And then finally, number four isn't so much technology, it's a consequence of technology and accelerating evolution. A Columbia business professor named Rita McGrath, you're familiar with Rita, said that as a result of all this accelerating evolution, that that sustainable advantage in any industry becomes more and more perishable. And therefore, even, you know, companies today that think they have a sustainable advantage will find out that the moats aren't as deep and the castle walls aren't as high as they used to be. The digital barbarians are at the gate. And she urged managers of companies, large and small, to become to arrange your companies to become more highly adaptable. I think there's, you know, this leads to the third observation out of four. Then in order to do that, I mean, you think every company today has to be a good digital company, and they have to be a good a cultural company as well. Sure. That they have to, you have to do a digital transformation at the pace of Moore's Law for your company, or you're simply, you know, some entrepreneur out there, some pure-born digital disruptor is going to hedge you off at the pass. Well, you know, you're a startup, you can run at the pace of Moore's Law. You're an existing organization, harder to do that. So how do you create, you know, how do you do that? And it's not only just having a great digital nervous system in your organization. And one tip that I've heard of recently is that if you take the chief information officer, the CIO, traditionally the person in charge of internal technology, that in more companies today, the CIO role is so consumed playing defense, cutting costs, guarding against network security threats, data security threats, regulatory compliance issues, that who is left in the organization to think about the offensive side, growing revenue, growing profit, you know, growing the brand? And Cisco has thought about this under its new CEO, Chuck Robbins. He has a direct report named Kevin Bandy, who's the chief digital officer. So I think every company needs at least one digital person reporting directly to the CEO. It could be the traditional CIO. That's how Fred Smith does it at FedEx. Or it could be this new offensive revenue-minded person called the chief digital officer. Mm. The other thing you have to do while you're building this digital backbone to evolve your model, business model, at the pace of Moore's Law, you have to have a cultural revolution. That's going to get to this peer-to-peer things that we talked about and the importance of teams and trust within an organization. But I want to skip past that to number four and then come back to this importance of culture. Okay. And how, why it leads to the importance of peer-to-peer networks is that if you look at, I like to think of this digital era of disruption. Clayton Christensen, you know, in his great book, The Innovator's Dilemma, reminded us that there have always been waves of disruption in business. But I think pure digital disruption was born with the web. The web is, you know, is a commercial available tool, appeared in 95. You know, from 95 to 2000, there was a lot of experimentation. There were companies like Amazon selling books and not much else. There were daily delivery of grocery companies like Webvan that raised $1 billion and failed, not because it was a bad idea, but because it was ahead of itself. The market of people on the web wasn't big enough. Most of us are experiencing the web through a dial-up modem. Then you had, from around 2000 to 2015, you had kind of the low-hanging fruit of disruption. So the web, the the pure web companies disrupted the heck out of the newspaper industry, my industry in magazines, travel services, a good portion of retail. And now what we're seeing is really profoundly different. Starting maybe a couple of years ago, and I think it's the early days, is that the web disruptors are now getting into, you know, let's call it the middle hanging fruit of disruption. And that is industries that thought that they were impervious from disruption: manufacturing, transportation, healthcare, financial services, you know, industries that had that have higher barrier to entries and have a good deal of regulation around them, which were both of which were thought to be, you know, moats and castle walls. And now, whether it's autonomous driving, whether it's Uber, whether it's a new version of a credit card or a credit company like Klarna in Stockholm, Sweden, where you don't have to give Klarna your banking information or your social security number, they'll deem you a credit risk worthy of a $5,000 purchase based simply on the analytics around you. You know, I mean, imagine what that's going to do to Discover and American Express. You think about health, what the revolution coming in healthcare. Now we're in a new era, and I think it really gets, it's, you know, strap on your seatbelt. I want to get back to this point that, you know, this point about teams and peers, because if it's a good idea to have a chief digital officer to think about the ongoing transformation of your company, you've got to meld it with a culture that is almost like a living organism that, going back to Professor McGrath's point, that things are moving so fast today, that if every decision in your company has to be made through an org chart, you're not going to make it fast enough. Mm-hmm. I gave a speech to Walmart in September to the top 500 managers in Bentonville, and one of the senior managers told me afterwards that technology, you know, they're very worried about Amazon and Alibaba. Remember, Walmart was the company that disrupted Kmart and Sears back in the day. And now they are at threat of being disrupted. And this guy said, we think we're pretty good about technology. It's the culture that has caused us to be too slow. Every conference call has 30 people in it. So how do you develop a culture where teams can arise spontaneously at just the right size, with just the right mix of, you know, intuitive thinkers and analytical thinkers, introverts and extroverts, men and women, you know, people of various hue, you know, to most perfectly solve the problem or chase the opportunity? And that, you know, you have to have a company where everybody understands what the company's mission is. And people almost have not only beyond a respect and admiration for each other, almost a love for each other, that you have a level of trust that is that your competitors or the disruptors can't take away. I believe a real driver to that is this peer-to-peer idea, whether it's within a company, yeah, or whether in the case of a lot of the people that you've worked with, where the founder or the CEO of a 100-person company or a 50-person company or a 500-person company kind of feels all alone many times, you know, feels the burden of being the head person in charge, doesn't want to be able to, you know, doesn't feel like it's quite right to be able to wear their heart on their sleeves because it might scare people. You know, people are human beings. You might go through a bad patch with your children or your spouse or your health, or simply a bad patch in your business. And, you know, who are the peers that can be within your company, but especially if you're a small company, I almost think by definition have to be outside your company. You know, most of us can't afford the big, you know, six-figure coach. And I think getting your coaching from peers is even more valuable because you get to an honest level of discussion. So I think the work that you're doing is absolutely the work that the world needs right now and can really accelerate the personal evolution of the leadership of these kinds of companies?
Well, there's no question that the challenges are great. You know, we learned, of course, talking to many CEOs who survived and even thrived through the 2008 financial crisis. And they said that they didn't do so because they were any better run companies than their competitors. They were better prepared. And the reason they were better prepared is because they had spent time around other CEOs who represented different sectors of the economy, and they had early warning signs, and they could be able to talk with one another about how to best prepare for what's going on. And you, what you talked about in terms of cultures having to move quickly, I think where large organizations were first challenged at this was in crisis communications, where it wasn't as though you had time to run up and down the organizational chart and draft a statement to have it ready for the evening news. It is now, you know, and they had to realize they had to move much more quickly and be much more nimble and have people on the ground be far more equipped to make decisions and trained to do that. In many respects now, those challenges now have gone beyond just the standard crisis, if you will, but so many other areas where we've got to move quickly like that. So it's a huge challenge.
Yeah, and everybody gets exhausted. Everybody feels like they run out of gas. I remember reading a book. I sort of cut my teeth in my late 20s in the advertising business. So I was a copywriter and a creative director for a small ad agency here in Silicon Valley, and I read a lot of. I read a lot of books, and one of them, a great book, was by David Ogilvy, the founder of Ogilvy and Mather. He was a Brit, and a great advertising leader of the 50s and 60s. And as he was building Ogilvy and Mather across the world, he would always give somebody the new head of an office in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, and you know, Paris, wherever they were opening up a new office. He would give them a series of these Russian nesting dolls. And inside the last doll, you'd keep opening up, you know how they work, you get to a smaller and smaller doll. And inside the smallest doll that said, if we hire people bigger than we are, we will become a giant, a company of giants. And if we hire people smaller than we are, we will become a company of small people. He used a less politically correct term. And you think about that, everybody runs out of gas. You know, nobody has it all. Everybody, you know, really good analytical CEOs sometimes don't have the empathetic, part of their repertoire that they need. And you get this with peers, and you get this with teaming with the people who are not necessarily like you. They're empathetic to your needs, but they're the ones who give, they're different than you. I'll never forget at Vistage, at one of the Vistage events in Seattle, when there was the opportunity to interview on stage Howard Bihar of Starbucks, who was the perfect number two and foil to Howard Schultz. Howard Schultz, tall, competitive, angular, athletic, analytical, driven, and it wasn't enough. Until he really, you know, hooked up with this grocery store consultant. You'd never formally educated was Howard Bihar, but his family owned grocery stores, so we knew business and the human side. And Howard, you know, and the two of them, the empathetic Howard Bihar going around and talking to store managers on a human-to-human basis and bringing back those human stories. I think later on, you know, Howard Bihar, as Howard Bihar retired from Starbucks in 2007, I think Howard Schultz became good at those empathetic things, but he didn't have it. And so here was a case of Howard Schultz reaching out to a peer, but a peer with different skills, you know, and that it was the two of them. And that's the power of peer-to-peer networks is, you know, you may be the analytical person who needs the you know, who really needs to get advice from a person of great intuition. You may be a great motivator, but you may have a hard time retaining, you know, your top people. Well, you know, find the peer in your peer group who might have where you can provide them something about motivating, and they can provide you something about retaining talented people. And that's the beauty is that in a peer-to-peer network, everybody lifts each other's skills.
No, I think that's so true. And, you know, you've mentioned too, even today, you know, we're in this hyper-connected world. Adaptability is critical. And as you're thinking about the future, it isn't just about what business leaders can do. You know, in a future podcast, we're going to have Linda Darling Hammond, who I know you know from Stanford. And a lot of what she talks about is it's not about, when we talk about educating our kids and preparing them for this future that we can barely imagine, that this is so much about, not about mastering skills, but learning how to learn together. In that learning is a social experience, and that together we can do so much in that regard. And I think for the world that you're describing and for the many challenges, and I agree, we can and should be optimistic about them. And I don't think together there isn't anything we can't face or accomplish, quite frankly, as long as we make the decision to do that.
You know, I like to think, Leo, of the two swings at bat that Steve Jobs had as CEO of Apple. He and Steve Wozniak started Apple in 76. You know, the Apple II came out in 77, the Mac in 84. Along the way, they went public. And of course, Steve Jobs recruited John Sculley to be the CEO. And a year later, they were at war with 2 years later, they were at war with each other, and the board voted with Steve Jobs. Now, in retrospect, it looks like a really dumb board decision, but at the time, it was a good decision. Mm-hmm. Steve Jobs was a loner, and I had to own everything, and my ego trumps everything in this organization, and he would backstab the very people he recruited. He was insecure. He had to do it all, and somehow it didn't count for him if he didn't do it all. Well, now, you know, between 85 and 97, the question is, what happened? Because when he came back to Apple in 97, he was one of the greatest CEOs we've ever seen. And what happened is that he learned to appreciate the strength of other people. Part of it was that he, while he was in the wilderness from Apple, he invested in Pixar. The two Pixar founders, John Lasseter and Ed Catmull, wouldn't put up with that egomaniacal Steve Jobs, and they let him know it. They let him know that you may own the company, but we can go across the street and we can start this company over. And so there was that recognition. There was the, you know, he gained some humility in the failure of Next, although it was a great operating system, and Apple eventually bought Next to get the operating system, and the OS system today comes from the Next kernel. It wasn't a technical failure, it was a business failure. Well, you look at when he came back in 97, and, you know, he didn't turn Apple around right away. He stopped the leaking. He got it focused. But it wasn't until the first breakthrough product outside of PCs, the iPod of 2001, and then, of course, the iPhone of 2007, along with the fact that he now assembled a team of people like Tim Cook and Johnny Ive and others, and this time he trusted them. And he didn't undermine them, and he had their backs, and all the things that he didn't do the first time around. And, you know, Jobs is never going to admit to a personal weakness, but you know that he had to confront that. And just by his behavior, you know, he was now behaving as a man who didn't think that he knew it all. He was the navigator. He was the captain of the ship. He was going to hire the best people, build the best organization, and it made all the difference in the world. You know, he died, you know, his death was a tragedy, and he died, you know, he died with people. He told Walter Isaacson, Walter Isaacson said, which invention were you most proud of? Which product? And he said, Apple itself. You know, both the birth of Apple, but the resurrection of Apple. But it took a profoundly changed Steve Jobs, who had respect for the, you know, the peers in his organization, you know, to get to that point.
Well, and I know in a recent talk that you gave, you talked about one of Steve Jobs' favorite team models was the Beatles. You know, this idea that they balanced each other, that the sum was greater than, you know, the parts, and that great things in business are really always done by a team of people. They're not done by one person. And I think it's a kind of, you just described really that transformation and that recognition of that, which I think was really remarkable.
And there were times when they didn't even like each other. In fact, were at each other's throats, but they had great, profound respect for each other. You know, I mean, Paul McCartney had a pretty good career afterward. John Lennon, not, you know, a brilliant but short career. Ringo is Ringo. Maybe you could say George Harrison had a breakout career simply because he was the least appreciated of the four. But none of them on their own accomplished what the four could together.
Yeah, no question about it. You know, just a final thing. My hope is that if I'm a CEO of maybe a small to mid-sized company, or I'm a business leader out there today, and I'm looking at this world that you described going into 2030 and 2050, what would be your advice to some of these CEOs in terms of how they approach their company, their cultures, technology, and all of that?
Well, I would find who is the smartest digital person in your organization. And if they're not there, and they're on the outside, get them. And you've got to have a direct digital report. It's all well and good, perhaps, that you have the CIO report to the CFO, but you've got to have somebody who reports, who's in your ear, who's really smart about technology and the consumer interfaces that have changed even B2B technology. That one is absolutely vital. I think you have to assemble a board of director or board of advisors that can help, that can be your peer set. And I'm a great believer, after having been exposed to it by you and the people that you've worked with, organizations like Vistage and others, and the work you're doing now, it's good to have people outside your industry. You know, I've met so many fascinating people from Howard Behar at Starbucks to Cameron Harold, the CEO coach that I've met through your network, that are profoundly valuable assets to have in your organization.
No, it's so true. They're terrific people. I think they, for a long time, have understood that they can't be the chief everything officer. They've got to lead, and they are best when they have help doing so. So, but anyway, look, I just want to thank you so much for joining us on the program today, and just really appreciate everything you're doing, and look forward to connecting with you again soon.
Thank you so much, Leah. It was an honor to be on your podcast.
All right, thanks so much.
Okay.
Bye now.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us today. To learn more about Peer Advantage, to submit questions to Leo and our guest, and to subscribe to the Year of the Peer podcast, please visit us at leobotari.com. That's LEOBOTTARY.com. This podcast is produced by me, Randy Cantrell, hosted, of course, by Leo Botari. Music provided by Kevin McLeod, Vibe Ace. Licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0 license.